we probably need to start preparing for the 2012 quota year, because they're indicating that we may lose our quota at that time.
Barrow leaders worry about their whaling quota after the International Whaling Commission meeting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 28th of June. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, with all the worry over paralytic shellfish poisoning, are commercial harvests safe?
We've not had the outbreaks in our commercial, the ground shellfish, that most other Lower 48 states have had.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
Alaskan Senator Mark Begich will get a chance tomorrow to publicly quiz the president's pick to run the Afghanistan war. General David Petraeus goes before the Senate Armed Services Committee and must win a majority of senators' support to move along in the confirmation process. His name is expected to quickly advance, but first the senators can question him about his plans, the war's direction, and the president's controversial goal to start drawing down troops by next summer. Senator Begich says he talked with Petraeus Friday and wants to hear more about what's being done to properly train Afghanistan personnel so they can do a bigger share of the heavy lifting rather than U.S. and NATO forces.
How many are actively working? In other words, training them up doesn't mean they're all online. Some are rolled out. They left the security forces. So what's that real number? And then how do we get to that final number that's going to be necessary for Afghanistan to protect itself and secure its own borders? That, to me, is a very important piece, because without the security component, you can't do the economic development. You can't do the new governance that's going on there.
Begich says his other great concern is over corruption in the government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
Taxpayer money that's being spent over there from this country, we need full value and not going half to services and half to some corrupt official that is not being prosecuted and put away for a long time.
Begich will only stick around for part of tomorrow morning's hearing because he's among a group of senators invited to the White House to talk climate change legislation. So has Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski. The meeting was slated for last week, but was postponed when President Obama had to see General McChrystal. Commercial shellfish harvesters in Alaska say recent cases of personal use paralytic shellfish poisoning, including two deaths, shouldn't affect their business. The state requires commercially grown shellfish to be tested on a regular basis to make sure it's safe for human consumption. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Alaska Shellfish Growers Association President Roger Painter owns and operates a commercial oyster and clam farm on Prince of Wales Island. He had one buyer cancel an order because of the recent PSP cases, but doesn't expect any lasting impact.
You know, it's never good when something like this happens, but my experience with PSP outbreaks in Alaska is that the market pretty much gets back to normal within 2 or 3 weeks.
In more than 20 years as a commercial shellfish farmer, Painter says he's only had 2 or 3 samples test over the limit for PSP. He says that's pretty impressive, considering the product is tested almost weekly.
There's a couple of farms here that have been operating about that long, but never had a sample even showing elevated toxin levels. So it's, you know, a very safe, sound program.
Paralytic shellfish poison can be found in clams, mussels, oysters, geoducks, and scallops, caused when they feed on algae containing high levels of toxins harmful to humans. The state requires commercial grow operations test those species for PSP. Samples are taken before each harvest and sent to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation in Anchorage. Results are typically ready in 3 to 5 days. A PSP toxin level of 80 parts per million in the edible tissue of shellfish will trigger a harvest closure or recall. Newer farms and farms with a history of PSP cases have to hold their product until they get the results. Long-running farms with a clean track record, like Painter's, are allowed to send product to in-state processors at the time they send samples to the lab. If those samples test over the limit, the product is recalled before being shipped to its final destination.
Over the last 3 or 4 years, PSP has been almost absent. So I wouldn't say we were feeling complacent about PSP, but we were certainly feeling a whole lot better than we have in past years.
Robert Presley is Seafood Safety Coordinator for the Department of Environmental Conservation. He says the state won't change its commercial testing standards due to the recent PSP cases from recreational and subsistence shellfish. In fact, the Food and Drug Administration just completed its annual survey of the state's PSP program, and it passed with flying colors.
Areas of our program are actually being used as models by the FDA because we've not had the outbreaks in our commercial grown shellfish that most other Lower 48 states have had.
DEC doesn't certify beaches for personal use or subsistence shellfish because it would simply be too costly and time-consuming given Alaska's vast shoreline. Presley says the only way to know the shellfish you're eating is safe is to buy it from a restaurant or store.
Untested shellfish, we do not recommend it be consumed, nor do we recommend that anyone consume the viscera of crab.
Some commercial harvesters would like to see a state-run program to test popular recreational and subsistence beaches. Phil Doherty is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association, a nonprofit economic development organization for fishermen, processors, and communities.
It's an expensive proposition, and I know that the economy is part of the deal and the cost of this program. But we would advocate that at least some beds in Southeast Alaska be tested on a regular basis.
Doherty notes that commercial growers pay for their own testing. He says SARDFA spends between $30,000 and $40,000 a year on PSP testing for gooey ducks alone. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The International Whaling Commission just wrapped up their meeting this year in Monaco. Harry Brower is the chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission based in Barrow. Brower attended the meetings and said there was a move by the IWC to change the subsistence quota timeline from the current 5-year to a 10-year system.
So that was the start of the request for the 10-year, and consensus was not reached on that proposal.
Brower says it's concerning that the IWC is increasingly polarized, with some factions supporting subsistence whaling and conservation groups that oppose all whaling. Alaska whalers lost their quota completely for a time in 2002, and attempts were made to block it in 2007, but the U.S. chair worked to get it reinstated. Brower says the current quota that expires in 2012 is not secure into the future.
For the 2012 quota year, because they're indicating that we may lose our quota at that time, but there needs to be that communications occurring between the conservation groups and the hunting groups.
Brower says one of the big problems is that concern over commercial whaling practiced by Japan, Norway, and Iceland is tainting the discussions for subsistence whaling, even though he says there is good science that shows subsistence whaling is sustainable. As politics plays a bigger role in IWC negotiations, more countries keep joining the commission. Brower says there were 82 countries a few years ago, and now there are 88. Some of them are not located on a coastline.
That are joining into the IWC, which have been brought in by two different sides, the whaling side, the non-whaling. So the numbers just continue to grow.
Brower says he hopes the members of IWC will eventually separate out the subsistence needs of indigenous people from the emotional controversy over commercial whaling. He says in Barrow, things are warming up and community members are getting ready to celebrate the bounty of their whaling tradition. This spring, Barrow whalers harvested 14 whales. Brower says preparations for a blanket toss tomorrow have people busy and looking forward to fun.
Everybody's happy getting together and having big family feeds and community festivities, people baking, cooking, studying in preparation for the festivities.
Brower says Barrow has already had two blanket toss celebrations and will have two more by the end of the month. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the debate over bear-resistant trash cans in Sitka.
It has had quite a few bear encounters. None have ever been successful in opening the can.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
And by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Alaska Native leaders from across the state met with Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Larry Echohawk in Fairbanks this morning. It was Echohawk's third visit to the state to hear directly about Alaska Native issues. Echohawk says he's learning a lot about a unique situation.
Alaska is greatly different than the lower 48, and that's one of the reasons I'm here, is to learn more about those differences and see what we can do to provide services up here.
Echohawk heard concerns about substance abuse, subsistence, climate change, and energy, but the central focus was a fundamental challenge created by the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSCA. The act gave land and shares in Alaska Native corporations to tribal members born after December 18, 1971. Harold Napoleon of the Native Village of Paimute, speaking on behalf of leaders who met over the weekend, says the act has resulted in more than 60% of today's Alaska Native people not having shares in their corporations.
We're losing children. We are losing people. We are orphaning a whole generation of Alaska Natives. They were born with no land, and so their ties to our ancestors have been severed. And these children, these young people, were even born with no hunting fishing rights and their tribal status in question.
ANCSA corporations have become the power centers of Alaska tribes. Napoleon calls the situation a tragedy and human rights issue because disenfranchised youth often turn to substance abuse and suicide. Some regional corporations have issued new stock to those born since the 1971 ANCSA cutoff, but Napoleon says tribes and corporations have to come together on a comprehensive resolution. Representative Don Young told attendees at the meeting he's willing to push a change.
I need you to put your heads together and figure out how we can do this, how it can be done, because it has to be done within this group. I can't wave that magic wand. I don't have it, but I can take away the wand you give me.
Young is close to the issue. His late wife, Lou, was Athabascan, and Young has 14 Native grandchildren who do not have any ANCSA Corporation stock. Assistant Secretary Echohawk says fixing the problem means changing ANCSA, and that's up to Congress.
There have been amendments over the years to that act, but it sounds, certainly that there's a great need for other attention to be given to revising the law.
Echohawk says in the meantime, he's working on addressing social ills Alaska Native people are struggling with. He says that effort is currently limited because Alaska is one of several states that have assumed law enforcement responsibilities for Native people. Echohawk says he's talked with Alaska's Attorney General about ways the federal government can work around that to help better serve Native communities. If you read the Sitka police logs often enough, one word describes the call that's listed again and again: bear. Sometimes it's a sighting of an actual bear, but many times the call comes in because someone sees trash strewn about a yard or along a road. The city has been looking for ways to keep trash away from bears. One of those proposals involves setting up bear-resistant trash cans along part of Cascade Creek Road as a trial program to see if it would work. But the assembly voted against conducting the trial program at its regular meeting last week. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
For residents of Sitka, a bear in your trash can is at best a nuisance and at worst a major safety hazard. For the bears, it's an all-you-can-eat extravaganza that turns city streets into an all-night buffet. Sitka has an ordinance prohibiting trash from being placed outdoors until the morning of pickup, and some residents have retrofitted their trash cans with latches. The city was considering a test program doing just that along the upper part of Cascade Creek Road. Before deciding on whether to do the test program, city officials performed an experiment. They took one of the garbage cans that would be used, a green plastic can fitted with latches on the lid, and they put it inside the habitat of Shaik and Kilisnu, the two bears who live at Fortress of the Bear in Sitka. They placed cantaloupe inside the cans and then watched and waited to see what the bears would do.
So he's going to roll this over a little bit, trying to figure out how to get into it.
That's Dan Jones, engineering manager for the city's Department of Public Works. He's narrating a video of the experiment as assembly members watch.
And I've got you to about a minute right here. And he's trying to figure out, pop, oh, there went one of the bolts on one side, and he's now figured out he's into it. He's going to dump it out here in a minute.
It didn't take long for the bears to get into the can, and the can itself did not fare well. In fact, it was almost flattened. The video goes on, but assembly members, including Jack Osment, said they had seen enough. The lights came back on, the video was turned off, and then Osment had some questions for Matt Dole, the statewide operations manager for Alaska Pacific Environmental Services.
This can that was in this test out of the zoo the other day, that's a lighter weight can than the green one we now have in town, isn't it?
Possibly, not much.
It seemed much more flimsy than the one that
But to a bear.
To a bear, Dole says, the difference is negligible, a point Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams seemed to echo.
For a brown bear, if we put salmon heads in the back of a Volkswagen, right?
The test program along Cascade Creek would have cost the city $2,000. McAdams had one question for Dole about the project.
I mean, will it work? Will it work? Is this $2,000 well spent?
No.
Okay, thank you. All right.
But not everyone agrees, including my neighbor, Steve Ash. We share a trash can that he's modified with two latches kept shut using two carabiner-like devices. He's a member of Sitka's Bear Working Group, and he's spearheaded an effort to get latches on trash cans.
It's one of the green square cans, and I've had latches on it for about 3 years. It has had quite a few bear encounters. None have ever been successful in opening the can.
Like Osment, Ash doubts the results from the Fortress of the Bear test.
I was there for that and was very disappointed that they chose to use a very flimsy trash can. It was not much more than a cardboard box. I mean, the bear put one paw on it, and the entire can just collapsed. You know, no latches are going to keep a bear out of something like that.
Assemblymember Larry Cruz was among those who said the $2,000 for the test along Cascade Creek Road would be better spent on education and enforcement of Sitka's existing bear and trash regulations.
People don't even close their cans. So I would like to see more of an enforcement issue put out there. And if one of the departments say they don't have enough money, well, here's $2,000 we can put forth to go get tickets, because they could probably fund themselves after that.
But Ash says that time has come and gone. The rules have been on the books for a while, he says, and still people leave garbage out on a regular basis. In May, two brown bear cubs were shot and killed by authorities not far from Ash's house after they were found near their dead mother. The mother had also been shot, although not by authorities. All three bears had been seen getting into trash in the hours prior to their deaths.
There's something wrong. This is not working, and to continue with this methodology makes no sense to me. I really believe we need to discourage bears from coming into town, discourage them from looking for food in trash cans.
The Assembly's unanimous vote against conducting the trash can test program kills the measure for now, but Assembly members say they'll look at other ways to improve enforcement of Sitka's bear ordinances in the future. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks is shutting down its primary economic development venture. The Office of Electronic Miniaturization is closing this week. What is the OEM? KUAC's Dan Bross explains.
The Office of Electronic Miniaturization, or OEM, deals with tiny things, but it was a big deal for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The idea was to break into the field of making the microchips that drive our increasingly high-tech world, from iPods to satellites. The OEM was established with federal funds to develop marketable technology, but UAF Vice Chancellor Buck Sharpton says the OEM migrated off mission toward basic research.
Which is good, but it was something less than the expectation that we had had from our federal delegation when it was designed. It was considerably less than what we had expected as the university, because we were promoting this thing as our crown jewel in our economic development program, right? And it was not.
The OEM was funded with millions of dollars in congressional earmarks channeled through Defense Department grants by former Senator Ted Stevens. Sharpton says the university made a conscious decision to stop seeking earmarks for OEM 3 years ago because the program, while fulfilling military research grants, hadn't developed anything marketable. Sharpton, who has extensive experience in the aerospace industry, says the venture was ill-conceived from the start.
It really never made sense for us to get into an activity where we were attempting to compete with people who had a long lead time on us and had much more capability and were surrounded by an industrial base that was interested in space-based components. The problem is that we can't make teeny tiny chips at the scale, the numbers that really make it economical.
Sharpton says the tanking economy hasn't helped the situation. He says he attempted to turn the office toward Arctic-specific projects that better match UAF's knowledge base and OEM's small-scale manufacturing capacity. The transition didn't happen fast enough, and with federal funds exhausted, the OEM is closing June 30th. The office features state-of-the-art technology and clean room facilities on and off campus that employ 10 staff, including several high-achieving foreign nationals. Assistant Research Professor Shiva Halavarad is very proud of the work done at OEM.
Because in the last 4 years, we have put almost 30 international peer-reviewed publications, 2 patents. So those achievements speak by themselves.
Halavarad and his wife, Nalima, a nanotech specialist, came to OEM 4 years ago. Their research on a temperature, pressure, and gas sensor for extreme environments was selected for presentation at the 2009 World's Best Technology Showcase in Texas. Halavarad says the UAF facility offers an unmatched working environment.
It is one of the most well-equipped laboratory to do microelectronics and nanotechnology research. We have one of top of state-of-the-art scanning electron microscope system that can get to 800,000 magnification. And that's the best in the country.
Halavarad says the OEM is also unique because the technology is all at one location. Halavarad is officially out of a job this week, but says he's not giving up on the OEM facility and its potential. He says he'll keep working to secure new funding.
If we start analyzing, looking things from the paycheck side, it's a big pain. But I'm not going to lose my optimism. I know it. Because if I lose my optimism now, it's very difficult to get it back.
Halavarad says several proposals are out for review, and he's not critical of Vice Chancellor Sharpton, who he calls a mentor. Sharpton confirms there's potential that OEM employees and technology may find new roles within the university if there's positive response to proposals. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska's former Senator Ted Stevens is reflecting on the life of his longtime colleague, Senator Robert Byrd, today. Byrd died this morning at the age of 92 after serving West Virginia in the Senate for more than five decades. Four of them were spent serving alongside and sparring with the 86-year-old Stevens, who lost his re-election bid in 2008. Stevens says when he first entered the Senate in 1968, Byrd took him aside for guidance. He was known to champion the Constitution, which he carried around with him everywhere, and was a stickler for procedural rules. Stevens says that could work in their favor because Byrd was a master at finding ways in the Senate to benefit his rural state. Stevens says even though they were on different sides of the political aisle, Byrd helped him advocate for his small population state.
But in terms of Alaskan issues, he really was our ally because West Virginia is a small state, and as a senator from a small state, he understood the problems of not having an enormous number of people in the House of Representatives. And he worked with us to show us the ropes and show us how we could get things done in the Senate. I think we did more through the appropriation process than Alaskans will ever know.
The two served for decades on the powerful Appropriations Committee, which Byrd encouraged Stevens to get on. And Stevens says his colleague was influential in legislation that's important in Alaska today.
He was very much involved in helping us with the Native Land Claim Settlement. He was involved in helping us with a 200-mile bill where we claimed the rights to have 200 miles off our shore. We have worked together on so many things. He was very much influential. He established the Appalachia Commission, and based upon that, I formed the commission that affected Alaska's future in a similar way. So we sort of followed one another.
When Stevens said goodbye to the Senate after losing his re-election bid in 2008, Byrd tailored an Irish prayer for the occasion.
May the sun shine warmly upon your face, Ted. May the rains fall softly upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you, Ted, in the hollow of his hand.
Stevens says he visited Byrd numerous times in recent months, including during his hospital stays, to talk about what was going on in politics and remember their days serving together in the Senate. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.